The following is an oral history interview with Irma Woods by Mark Robbins for the South Texas Hispanic Farm Labor Community's Oral History Project. The interview took place on March 4th, 2013 in Corpus Christi, Texas.
This is Irma Woods.
Yes, sorry. I want to begin talking about the history that I know of my maternal grandparents, and actually great-grandparents. My great-grandparents came to the United States in 1911. They were fleeing the Mexican Revolution in Mexico. And there was many people fled Mexico at that time, and they came to the United States. So they went to Yorktown, which was at that time settled by families from Poland. A lot of Polish people living in the Yorktown area. And my great-grandfather, and I wanted to show this picture to you, Mark,
because
my grandmother, who was 14 years old in this picture, she just did this with every photo. She would write, this is written in Spanish, but she would write a description of everything. Give the names of all the people in the photo, talk about the trees, the animals. She wrote that this photo was taken at 2 in the afternoon. She would give great detail. 2 in the afternoon, January the 6th, 1914, and talked about the animals and the families and so on. And she would do that with every photo, so that she left a recorded history just
That's
based
great.
On the photos. So my great-grandparents came, and they became sharecroppers. They worked the land, and they were paid very, very low wages. But they kept part of the crops, part of the produce. And they would use that to feed their families, because my grandmother married at the age of 16, and she and my grandfather had 19 children.
Oh, my.
So wow. It was a huge family to live, and they lived... And they became sharecroppers as well. They worked the land, kept a little bit of the produce, and earned very, very low wages. My grandfather, based on my grandmother's stories, he would earn 50 cents a day for a full day's work, from the day the sun rose until it set. And then all the children helped as well. They lived in a two-room house, no, one room with a small kitchen. There was no, of course, indoor plumbing. It was outhouses. But one big room where they would all sleep on the floor, and the small kitchen for cooking, but some of the cooking was done outside as well. And so my grandmother would make the soap. She would make most of the products for use in the house. They picked cotton. The children were given short sacks, so they could fill them up. The grown-ups were given the long sacks, and they were paid like 10 cents a pound for picking cotton. And anything left over, the pickings that were left from picking cotton, the landowner would tell my grandmother she could have them. So she would go and pick the leftover, whatever was left over, and then she would use that to make the mattresses for the family, the pillows, and things like that. So they lived off the land in terms of food. They never went hungry. My mother recalls they never were hungry because there was always food because they... Whatever crop was growing, they would always have something to eat. My mother married at the age of 15, but she went to school. She never finished school. The highest she went was the fifth grade, and she went to a school in Yorktown called Bessing Elementary, which is no longer there. But there was great discrimination against Mexican Americans, and so the school had two rooms. One for the white children and one for the Mexican children. And they were called Los Mexicanos, the Mexicans. The records show the names of all the white children, but they didn't keep records on the names of the Mexican children. It is as if they did not exist. Years later, I wanted to find out more information on the school my mother attended, so I wrote to the Historical Society in Yorktown requesting information about this Bessing school. And the lady was very gracious. She sent me as much as she could. She sent me pictures of the school. And she tracked the names of the children who attended the school in the years that I had indicated. But they were all the names of the white children. She didn't have any records of the Mexican children, so I could never verify my mother attended the school. Because my mother said they didn't think that they were important. They didn't think the Mexican children were important. And because they left early, arrived late in the school year because they followed the crops, I guess the school officials felt it wasn't necessary to keep track of them. They'd come and go, and therefore it was not necessary to record their attendance or anything like that. So anyway, then my parents, when my mother married at the age of 15, my father was much older. They moved to Corpus Christi to find a better life. You know, my father went to work at a restaurant. Mm-hmm. My mother became a seamstress. There was a former laundry called the Oriental on Staples in Morgan. Now I think it's a recording studio. The building's still there, but it used to be a laundry. And my mother was a seamstress. She would sew the buttons and do hems on clothing that got damaged and things like that. And she worked there to augment the salary of my father. But my mother always worked outside the home while we were growing up. I don't remember ever being at home as a child and my mother being at home. She always worked outside the home. Education was really important to them, I guess because they felt they didn't have any. Mm-hmm. They wanted to make sure that we had an education. So I soon learned that if I used the excuse I had homework, I didn't have to do the dishes. But if I said, I have to read this library book, Mom, then I didn't have to do housework because they valued education so much. And they didn't question. They didn't see if I really had homework. They just, if I said I had homework, I must have homework. And so they, okay, you don't have to do the dishes. You don't have to clean. You don't have to do that. But my parents, and while I don't remember a single time my parents reading a book to us or playing, they never played with us. Life was really different. Mm-hmm. They didn't, the idea that parents played with their children was unheard of. They worked so hard. They worked so hard just to put food on the table, pay bills. And I heard that all my life. We got to pay the bills. We got to pay the bills. Where are we going to get the money to pay the bills? You know, mm-hmm. that we didn't question the fact that they didn't play with us or read books. But what they did do was they modeled. They modeled for us. My father, as little money as we had, he always subscribed to the Caller Times. There were two newspapers. One in the morning was called The Caller. The one in the afternoon was called The Times. And it was not until years later that the two were combined, what we know today, The Caller Times. One newspaper. But we used to have two, morning and afternoon. And my father got both, which was unheard of in our little neighborhood. And I would see him reading the newspaper. So he gave me the message that reading is important. Reading must be important because he would come home and read both newspapers. And that was the modeling that I saw growing up. Mm-hmm. We lived in a neighborhood that was all Spanish-speaking. Everybody spoke Spanish. And it was sort of like self-contained. Everything we needed was right there. It was on the west side. We had our grocery store. We had our theater. We had our church. We had the laundry. We had everything we needed. We didn't need to venture anywhere out. Going to Air Street was like going to another town. It was so different. And Spanish was the only language spoken. Even the mailman, who was African-American, spoke Spanish. And I couldn't believe that. I thought, how does he know Spanish? He doesn't look like us. You know, how did he learn to speak Spanish? But he did, because it was just hard for me to understand how anybody who did not look like us could speak our language. And I went to the neighborhood school, and I remember the principal of the school would go visit the neighborhood to make sure the children were attending school. And I was really impressed that the principal would walk the streets to make sure that we were attending school. He spoke no Spanish, and I hadn't entered school yet, and he spoke no, and I spoke no English, and he would come to the house, and I couldn't communicate with him. I entered first grade without any background, early childhood or preschool or kinder or anything. I just went straight from a home environment where only Spanish was speaking to school where only English was speaking. And this was in the 50s, late 1940s, early 50s. And the whole idea was that you spoke English, that Spanish was forbidden. And so at home, I was always called Irma or Irmita. Irmita is the diminutive. It's a nurturing term. In Spanish, we use that for everything. Casita, cafecito, you know. It's a nurturing term. And so we take people's names and we make them, it softens the name and shows nurturing is the best way I can describe it. And so I was called Irmita or Irma. I went to school and they called out the name Irma. And I did not respond because that was not my name. Mm-hmm. They called it out again. They never called my name. They never called my name, what I knew to be who I was. Mm-hmm. And so they went to my house because the principal told my parents that I was not going to school.
Oh, wow.
And I've been going every single day. It's just that they didn't pronounce my name correctly. And so they told me that that my name was Irma and I had to respond to that name. And so I soon learned that my name in Spanish was not valued. It was valued at home, but not valued in school or in this other society that I was becoming. And so I began to call myself Irma. It was not until many, 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 many years later where I finally reclaimed my identity. And then use only my name in Spanish, pronounce it. And if people cannot pronounce it, that's okay. I tell them, that's all right. That's okay. It's just that this is how I pronounce it. And I do understand. I did marry a white man. And people say, how could you have done that? Because when you love somebody, you don't look at certain things. You know, and that didn't matter. It just did not matter. But it was very difficult going to school in a society that did not value our culture, our traditions, who we were. Everybody in the school was everybody was poor. So we were all Mexican children, so to speak, and we all came from the same area, the same neighborhood. It was truly segregated. Simply, that's just the way it was because of where you live, the neighborhoods, and so on. But one year, when I was in the fifth grade, a little white girl enrolled in the school. Her name was Dorothy, and she was the only white girl, and she was in my classroom. And so when the first 6 weeks, when we were issued our report cards, the teacher came to me and said, you made the highest grades in the class, but I cannot put them on your report card because we know that nobody can score higher than a white child. Mm-hmm. So, because Dorothy was white, she had to have the higher grade. So she said, I just tell your parents that you're doing really well, but you cannot have the highest grades because Dorothy has to have them. And I didn't question it. I said, okay. You know, I've always been a very quiet child, shy to a large degree. And so I just accepted that's just the way it was. That's just the way the conditions were, that Mexican children were supposedly inferior in knowledge and skill and intelligence, and that's just the way it was. And I told my parents, and they didn't question it either. They just accepted it. That's just the way it was. That's the way society was at the time, and you didn't make a fuss. You didn't complain. You just went along with it. And so that I remember clearly, very clearly too, is the punishment we received for speaking Spanish at school. We were made to kneel on the gravel, on the asphalt road, in the little areas outside, the asphalt. We had to kneel during recess. The teacher would also take a ruler and hit us on the legs every time we spoke Spanish. or we had to put up our hands and she would hit us on the knuckles with the, so that we would not speak the language, because she said you have to learn English. And I learned English. I didn't have to lose my language, you know. Mm-hmm. So at home we continued to use Spanish. At school I learned to speak English. And I remember a teacher telling me that I would probably not go beyond elementary school, that I probably wouldn't go beyond elementary school because I spoke Spanish. You know, you don't speak English. It's not your language. You probably will only go to the sixth grade and you'll probably drop out. And so there was little encouragement. There was no talk about high school. There was absolutely no talk about going to college or anything like that. But there was something in me that wouldn't accept that. You know, that it just wouldn't accept it. So I silently vowed that I would show that teacher. I would show her that I had the ability and the capability. And so I intentionally majored in English in my bachelor's degree, intentionally, to show the teacher that I would master this language and that not only would I learn to speak the language correctly, but that I would write it correctly as well and become familiar with the writings in the English language. And so I think back and think, how could I have thought that? But anyway, I purposefully minored in Shakespearean literature. And it was a way to show the world that I could do this, that they were not going to tell me I was incapable just because I spoke a language other than English when I first went to school. And so as a child, I encountered many, many incidences like that. But it's hard to explain. It was just an accepted way of life. And you didn't fight it. You didn't try to change it. It was not until I went to college, Our Lady of the Lake in San Antonio, that I in the 60s, that I became an activist. That I learned to use the boycott as a way to resist discrimination. And so I joined the Cesar Chavez. I joined the Cesar Chavez movement, boycotted the stores in San Antonio selling grapes. Didn't eat grapes for like 3 years. My grandmother, in the meantime, they left the fields of Yorktown, they left the hard labor, also came to Corpus. And she became active with the movement of Dr. Garcia, GI Forum. She became, and I have a letter from Dr. Garcia appointing my grandmother as a person who has his authority to organize GI forums in the United States.
Oh, wow.
So she became an activist as well. And she began to travel South Texas, went to New Mexico to establish GI Forum chapters for women. She was one of the organizers. And I recently came into possession with which I prize, this photo of my grandmother. This is my grandmother. As she's organizing GI forums in New Mexico to fight for justice for the veterans coming back after the war.
Wow.
I remember my grandmother, just a great woman with boundless energy, doing fundraisers to send them to college. We would do cakewalks and we would do this concept of queens. You know, you ran to be a queen and you collected money from your supporters and all the money went for scholarships. So that's where I heard this concept of scholarships for college. And it was my grandmother who promoted that and worked tirelessly. She didn't have a higher education at all. She only finished la primaria, as we say in Spanish, elementary school. But Dr. Garcia called her la profesora because she worked so hard to promote education. She followed the ideals of Dr. Garcia and worked tirelessly to promote education. She taught all her children to read and write in Spanish. So my mother, when she went to school in Yorktown, she was already literate. She knew how to read and write Spanish, but that was not valued. that language was not valued, so it was determined that she was illiterate because she didn't know English, mm-hmm. or could write English. But my grandmother, until she could no longer help, gave way. She continued to promote education, do fundraisers, and send people to college. And I think, and really, my desire for higher education really came from my grandmother. She's the one who supported me. She was the one who told me I was smart. Nobody had ever told me that before. You know, nobody had said, you know, you really are smart. You have potential. You can do this. But it was my grandmother who said, you can do this. You can go to school. You can, because you are very intelligent, and you need to do that, and I will help you. And she did. So who I am today, to a large extent, I owe it to my grandmother, who worked the fields. She had so many children, and her story is a unique one because she would work the fields alongside my grandfather while she was pregnant, and she would leave the fields to go have her baby. And in numerous times, she had her babies by herself.
Oh, wow.
Because they were out in the, you know, out at the ranches, and no neighbors, really close, no access to a hospital, so she would give birth by herself. And call, if a midwife was close by, they would call a midwife. My grandmother, my mother remembers when she was 12 or 14, running to a neighboring house to get somebody to help when my grandmother was giving birth. But many a time she left the fields when labor pains began, and would go have her baby, stay in bed for a couple of days, and then go back to the fields. It was a hard life. It was a very hard life. It was a life of impoverishment and just a lot of discrimination. But my grandmother was such a strong woman. She didn't see it as an obstacle, but as a reason to fight harder, to fight the right way. Not an aggressive, no violence at all, but standing up and speaking up for what was right, for justice. And so my parents, my father went from working in a restaurant to, he got a job building the HEB warehouse that's out there on 37, is it? No. You know what I'm talking about?
I think
about?
I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, he worked on that, and then he worked at the base civil service until he retired. And my mother worked as a seamstress at the Oriental Laundry, and then went to work in a fabric store and worked in retail until she retired. So to them, they really, their life became better because they went from working in the fields to, well, moving to the city and working retail. But still experiencing a lot of discrimination with unfair wages, the white people getting paid more because they were white. But my parents, they just said, you know, I remember my father saying, when you go look for a job, always keep your hands out of your pocket. Always have them out so your employer knows you're ready to work. That you don't have your hands in your pocket, because that's an indication you're lazy.
I never thought of that.
That you don't want to work. So always have your hands out, that you're ready to work. And he always stressed, any job that is a legal job is okay, no matter how humble. Never be too proud to work at any job, as long as it's honorable work. And he would tell us, an honest day's pay for an honest day's work. Don't cheat, tell the truth, all those things. All those character traits that are so critical for us as human beings, I learned them from my parents. And they modeled for us the right way to live. And they never complained. That's what I... Why didn't you say something? But they never complained. That's just the way it was in those... That's the way of thinking, and until they retired, and then all of us, my siblings, myself, all their children are college educated. We all have college degrees. We all are, I think, upright citizens, productive citizens, and they've always said that that is their greatest pride, that we grew up this way. My grandmother, to the end, she worked hard, tirelessly. And I don't know what else you want me to say.
Well, I mean, that's all extremely interesting and I think important stories to have. Do you recall hearing from your mother or grandmother or any other family members what sort of things when they weren't, you know, working tirelessly, it sounds like, that they would do, whether religious activities or any time for recreational activities or...
Well, church was a mm-hmm. big social event. It was a gift. The church played a big part in my life. We're lifelong Catholics, and mm-hmm. the Catholic Church was the center of the neighborhood. You went to church on Sunday. You actually went to church every day, every day at Mass. Mm-hmm. And the social events at the church, the bingos, those were big things. The jamaicas, I remember the jamaicas, festivals, I guess is the best word for it. Fundraisers for the church, but big, big events. But even within the church that I grew up as a child and that my parents attended and supported for years and years, even those priests were discriminatory mm-hmm. because the priests came from Spain because we needed Spanish-speaking priests. It was a Spanish-speaking church, and mm-hmm. so there were no local Mexican priests. It was unheard of that Mexican young men would go to the seminary and become priests. All the priests were white, and it was a given because the image of God was a white mm-hmm. God. Jesus was white, God was white, the Blessed Mother was white. You know, we did have Our Lady of Guadalupe, and so she's greatly revered in the Mexican community because she's brown like us. Mm-hmm. But the church was the social center of the life of the people. But even there was the discrimination. I remember the priest from Spain telling us that we were inferior because we were not Spaniards, that we didn't speak the Spanish of Spain, the Castilian, that we spoke the local Spanish, that we were los indios, the Indians. We came from the Aztec Indians, and therefore we were not pure like the Spaniards were. And so even there, we were humiliated and kept almost subjugated because we were not as good as the Spaniards. So even the church promoted that. But... the festivities, my father became a deacon in that church, and so very, very active. That was the center of our social life, the church. I went to public school, but my younger sisters went to Catholic school. And there at that church, they had a Catholic school, and they would have all kinds of festivities. They would have plays that the children put on at Christmas. They'd have events. So, but that was our social life, the church. All the singing in the choir, the jamaicas, the cakewalks, those are all for fundraisers for the church, but it was our social outlet. And I remember going to church every day and then having to go to confession every Saturday. And I didn't have any sins. It's like, what do I tell the priest? We had to go to confession. You know, the idea that we were sinful and you had to confess your sins, and I couldn't think of what. So I would make them up. Mm-hmm. And in that way I was lying. You know, but I didn't think that far. But the church had a tremendous influence in our lives.
Was there access to a church or religion and when they were working back in the fields? Or most of the memories that you have or tradition coming from...
They didn't have it. When they were working in the fields, they had the Catholic Church in Yorktown. My parents got married at that church. But they lived out on the farm, so they did not attend... No, they did not attend religious services simply because of the distance, mm-hmm. but they did get married in the Catholic Church. But they would hold their little prayer groups at the farm. You know, they would gather and have little prayer groups. They would have... On Sundays were big days for the families on the farm. That's when they visited each other, they cooked, mm-hmm. and they all went and shared their food. The gathering was like a big picnic, my mother would say, like a huge picnic. Everybody would take what they could. Everybody was poor, mm-hmm. so everybody would take what they could and then they would share. And they would stay. My mother recalls staying, as a child, staying up till midnight talking. The adults sharing and talking, the men drinking and the women sharing stories and cooking and, you know, baking bread and stuff. And mother says as children, they look forward to Sundays because there was a lot of activity and they didn't have to work. They didn't have to work in the fields because they honored the Sunday as a day of rest. So it was a day for them all to gather together and they would play. They didn't have toys. There were no toys available, so they would make their toys. They would make cloth dolls. The boys would get, they would get, make their balls with mud and leaves and wrap them around and tie string around them, and that's how they would make their little balls. And with sticks they'd play baseball. Mother and her sisters and all the other girls would make the little dolls out of cloth or corn husks. They would make their little dolls. They would get boxes and make little cars and little baby beds and things like that. But all their toys were homemade. They never had a purchase toy available to them. So my mother continues to be very creative in terms of making do with very little and recycling. Today we call it recycling, but in those days, very creative in the way they made, they played. And that's something I've wanted to research myself simply because of my field. I want to know the play activities, the toys that they played with, so I've been doing a little research on that. So I can find, you know, I know some, but not enough. Because to me, that's fascinating. And they would use whatever they had, the natural resources available, rocks and sticks and leaves and grass. They would use natural resources to play and make, make their game. I mean, they made up games. They didn't have any store-bought toys, so they would make no technology at the time. So they made all their games. They didn't have things even like marbles, you know. They would get rocks, and they would they made kites out of sticks and cloth, and so those were their play elements that they had.
That's really interesting. That would be a neat thing to learn more about that.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things. It's hard to find that information except through the stories of people that remember or heard stories from their loved ones. So when your mom and your grandmother became activists, did they work with a lot of the same people that they had previously worked with on the farms? Or
actually, my mother was not an activist. My mother didn't like anything like that. She just, like, don't talk to me about that. She just did not like that. My grandmother was the activist. And she would go around the neighborhood and go back to the farms and recruit people and talk about the importance of sending children to school and supporting Dr. Garcia's efforts at the GI Forum. She would speak. She was a natural speaker, and she would speak about issues. I found that so surprising that my grandmother could do that. I remember standing and listening to her. Wow, she can get in front of people and she can talk about what's important. It had a great impression on me because she could do that. She could energize people. She could pull people together and do that, it seemed, with so little effort. And she only developed that skill under the guidance of Dr. Garcia because his office on Bright Street is right around the corner from Verbena Street where my grandmother lived. So he was a family doctor for years and years and years because he was right around the corner. And so she had, my grandmother was a very gregarious person. She loved people, she loved to talk, and she gathered people around her. So she had lots of friends, lots of acquaintances. And if she didn't know them, she made sure that they became friends. Everybody was a cousin or somebody's, everybody was related to her in one way or another. And she would go back to the farms in Yorktown, Rangi, Nordheim. Those are the areas where I remember they went from farm to farm. And then in here in Corpus, during the summer, they'd go and pick cotton. And she would talk to people and gather, come, let's meet. They would do tamaladas, meaning get all the women together in the kitchen and make tamales. And because that's a laborious task, making tamales. You've got to make dozens and dozens and dozens to feed so many people. And while they were making tamales, all the women chattering and talking, my grandmother would talk about these issues that were very important. So it was like in her home, she carried on a crusade. And that's the best way I can describe it. Mm-hmm. And because my mother worked outside the home, she left me in the care of my grandmother. My mother was working at the Oriental Laundry at the time. I was very little, maybe four or five, because I wasn't in school yet. And I would see my grandmother gathering all these people in her house and talking about the importance of this and this and this. And it became a natural, it simply became a natural occurrence for me to witness that, to be a part of that. And so then when I had an opportunity in college, I knew that was important. I knew that was important to speak up and to speak up for justice and human rights in my own quiet way. But I knew that was important. I could not stay silent on issues like that. And today, in my own quiet way, I continue to do it.
Wow, that's really interesting, especially hearing about the tamale activism. that's really, really neat. And I think that's one of the things that increasingly researchers are noticing, that oftentimes the spaces of activism and change come from places that aren't always in the boardroom or the White House.
And they're not in the news. They're not in the news. They're not recorded anywhere. It's the experiences that people have in the U.S. Mm-hmm. You know, where did you first learn that idea of it may come from somebody's kitchen?
Right.
It may come from somebody's, what you're playing in the playground. Places and times that you would have never thought possible. I guess that's what they call the grassroots movement.
Right.
Where it's in the neighborhood, in the individual homes. And my grandmother just had a capacity for being able to understand that and to promote it, being that it was not her experience growing up. Mm-hmm. But she herself witnessed a lot of the discrimination, a lot of the unfairness, the bad treatment that Mexican people had, and no way to speak up, no way to have their voices heard until she finally found a way. And then she embraced it totally, just totally, and to the end. She spoke up, told me I was smart, I had to go to school because I could do this, you know. And I remember when I was going to A&I at that time in Kingsville, I had to take the bus. So there was a commuter bus that went from Corpus Christi to Kingsville, transporting students from Corpus to Kingsville. They don't have it anymore, but when I was in school, they did, back in the 60s. And she lived in Armada Housing Project by then.
Oh, yeah.
And so the bus stopped at Arcadia Village, which is right there by La Armada. That's where the bus would pick us up. And she would tell me, "Mijita, you go, come just 30 minutes early and I'll have breakfast for you so you don't go to school hungry. Because I have to walk from my house to Arcadia Village to get the bus." And so I'd stop at her house. She would have breakfast ready for me so that I would have something to eat. She would say, "So that you can learn well. You've got to have food so you can learn well." And then I get on the bus, spend all day in Kingsville at the university, and then come back in the evening and she'd have dinner for me ready. So that, she said, "I know you're hungry." She supported me in those ways, you know, until I got my degree. And she was an amazing woman.
She certainly sounds that way. Wow. And what were your impressions in terms of your memories of Dr. Garcia? And I remember you mentioned to me before that you had some memories, not just in the doctor's office, but elsewhere. Do you have specific things that stood out there?
Dr. Garcia was an imposing figure, I have to say. He had a strong voice, and he's, how do you say it, when somebody we say in Spanish, no tiene pelos en la lengua. It's a saying that, in other words, he was not afraid of saying what had to be said, and he came out and said it. He was blunt, he spoke. People would have mistaken him for being gruff, because he just spoke, and just the way things were, this is the way it is. And he would rapid. His language was fat. And when I was in the fifth grade, I don't know if I told you, but I loved to play sports. When I was a child, I loved to play sports. I played basketball and baseball. And never played football, but anyway. I was playing baseball, and the person in front of me, I was next to bat, but the person in front of me hit the ball and threw the bat and hit me. The bat hit me right here. And so they called mother, and she came. Of course, Dr. Garcia was our doctor. Mm-hmm. And she took me immediately to his office. And he's the one who stitched me. So I have his stitches right there. It used to be here, but with age, the skin has moved down, and it's here now. But he was a no-nonsense man. I mean, he was all business. You do what you got to do, and you do it well, and you know, and he took care of it, and he said, now you're going to go to bed just for today, but tomorrow you go back to school. Mm-hmm. You're going to be okay and go back to school. He was a fiery speaker, fiery. He just spoke, and he was he was fast. He would go from here to here to here to here to here, just on and on and on. He was greatly revered by the Mexican people, revered, honored. People just loved him. Mm-hmm. I would go to some of his speeches, and I was just amazed at his capacity to use language to say what had to be said, and he inspired people to take action, get up and do something. Don't just take it; do something about it. He was very charismatic, and eloquent at the same time, but blunt, gruff to some degree. When my grandmother died, he came to her funeral and spoke at her funeral and called her La Profesora. He said, La Profesora has died, but she has left a legacy of promoting education among our people. I will never forget that. So, he was a great man.
Certainly, absolutely. And it's neat to hear some of the personal reflections there. I've mostly just read about it, really. Well, entirely just read about it myself, but
yeah.
And until very recently from afar, from halfway across the country. So, and you had said that you had participated in activism in college. Was that part of the walkout movement, or mentioned Cesar Chavez?
When the boycott of grapes, mm-hmm. he came to San Antonio. I was in San Antonio at the time, mm-hmm. and he came with his movement to boycott grapes, and I joined the boycott. I joined the demonstration on the streets of San Antonio. Huelga, huelga, and I was holding up the sign, huelga, strike. Is that huelga is the Spanish word for strike. And I was so excited that being, and by now the terms had changed, we were now Chicanos, we were Mexicans when I was a little girl, and it was seen as a very, to be a Mexican was to be the lowest of the lowest, you know. You were nobody because we were not smart, we were poor. We spoke a language that was not the language of the mainstream society. But by college, that had changed to Chicanos, where you took pride in being brown. You took pride in standing up and speaking up. And while I still was quiet, because I've never been an aggressive person, I've always been nonviolent, you know, never used bad language in my life. And that was part of my religious upbringing, how I was brought up in the church forever. But I did develop an attitude that we should not take injustice and not do something about it, that we needed to stand up and speak up and act against injustice and to use the pen to write, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when his movement came, boycotting the grapes, then I joined the movement, and we boycotted grocery stores, Piggly Wiggly in San Antonio, the different stores, the grocery stores in San Antonio, telling people not to buy grapes, and joining the different marches for the farm workers. That was... My children today can't believe I did that when I was much younger. But actually, my son, Mom, we're so proud of you. We're so proud of you, Mom.
Yeah. And did you remember a lot of backlash from retailers?
They would throw rocks at us, tell us to get out, go home, Mexicans. They didn't say Mexicans. They didn't pronounce it correctly. Mexicans.
Oh, my.
They pronounced it Mexicans. Go back to Mexico, you Mexicans. They would throw rocks at us. They would spit, you know. They would, but we marched peacefully. We never, And I never, I was never violently hurt or anything like that. It's just the words, how they looked at us. And so some of that, much of my memories are not pleasant ones, but I'm very glad I participated. I'm very glad I stood up and spoke out against injustice because the farm workers, the conditions of the farm workers in California and so on. And then in Texas, treated so poorly as well. Mm-hmm. But for a long time, even after the boycott was called off, I still would not eat grapes for a long time. It was like, I couldn't, So I got to meet Cesar Chavez, and he was another friend, just an amazing man, a humble, quiet, unassuming man, a small, short of stature, but so humble, so unassuming, but spoke forcefully and with conviction. And his demeanor very different than Dr. Garcia, because Dr. Garcia was forceful. He was forceful. But Dr. Garcia was a medical doctor. He had an advanced degree behind him. He was educated. Cesar Chavez was a humble man, without the education that Dr. Garcia had, and without the big supporters that Dr. Garcia had. And Cesar Chavez, just a quiet, humble man. But when he spoke, you listened, because there was something about him that just was mesmerizing when he spoke about the injustice of the people towards our people. Mm-hmm. And always, of course, Cesar Chavez is also nonviolent. You don't use violence to get your ideas across. The same teachings of Martin Luther King, the same teachings. So I have, and that's why people, often told me they couldn't understand how I could have married a white man. They just couldn't understand that. They called me a coconut, white on the inside and brown on the outside.
Wow.
And that was my own people calling me that, because I was told many times, how could you have betrayed your people by marrying a white man? How could you do that? And then when we had children, some people would call my children, and that's probably what hurt me the most, half-breeds. We'd call them half-breeds. When my daughter won the national, she was a national merit finalist to go to college. One of her schoolmates said, well, the only reason you scored so high is because you have a white father. And when Audrey came and told me that, she said, Mom, guess what so-and-so said? And it was just like, what? Yeah. And she said, and I said, so what did you do, Audrey? What did you do? She said, well, first I was just going to walk away, like you tell us, just walk away. But then I got angry, and I went back and I said, you know something? You haven't met my mother. Mm-hmm. Told that to her friend, and the girl was like, I said, good for you, Audrey. Good for you.
Yeah.
But my children experience. And so I didn't teach my children Spanish so they wouldn't suffer like I had suffered. And then they they chided me for not teaching them the language, you know. So my daughter, Audrey, after she got her college degree, she joined the Peace Corps, and she went to Nicaragua so that she could learn Spanish. And she came back fluent in Spanish.
Wow.
And then my son, Paul, went to Mexico and lived in Mexico so he could learn Spanish. And they would, oh, how, why didn't, Mom, you could have taught us. Oh, I said, that's a long story. It was too hard. It was, I didn't want you to suffer like I had suffered. And so the story of my grandparents, my great-grandparents, closely related to my own story of justice and fairness. And so why did I marry a white man? Because I fell in love with him. Mm-hmm. And that's the only explanation I can give. I said, when you love somebody, you look beyond the color of their skin, where they come from, their traditions, their values. We don't even share the same religion. Mm-hmm. And that was another point of contention. but that's never been a problem. We've always made things work. And I'm very grateful. I wouldn't change that for anything. But it was hard, you know,
yeah,
when people don't understand. They thought I was trying to show I was better. My own people would say, you're just trying to be better than the rest of us. You know? And, you're betraying my people. You're betraying your own people. You should have married a Mexican man. What can I say? You marry the person you love. Mm-hmm. And that's just the way it is. Right?
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting. I don't have any story in terms of the ethnic or racial politics of it, but you know, my wife and I were not from the same religion, and I remember, you know, I went through a premarital Catholic Church training and everything, and it was interesting. I think I was the only non-Catholic there, but they were pretty good about it. I must say, at least the church I work with, they were most interested in creating or putting us in position to have the best loving marriage.
That's right.
And you know, there's a religious framework for that that can be related to just general kind of the human decency.
That's right.
And it was great because I could be perfectly honest about things I agreed with or disagree with, and an open discussion, so I was really privileged to not have other aspects to deal with there. And
the only thing is, my husband did agree that the children would be raised as Catholics, and that's how it happened. They're all Catholic.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll stop it there.